Dear friends of Jesus Christ, I heard a story of a rich man. It wasn't the rich man Jesus talked about, but he was a rich man and a mean man. And when he became very old and near death, he decided that he did not want his money to go to his wife or children, since he was the one who had worked for it. And he told his wife to promise him that she would take all his money and bury it with him when he was buried. And then he called a lawyer, made an official statement, and had her sign it that she did indeed promise to bury his money with him. So on the day of his death, as the casket is lowered into the ground, someone whispered to his wife, who knew about the promise he had made, "Did you put all his money in the casket?" And she said, "I did. I wrote a check." "For the full amount of all that he is worth, and I added a small note. You can cash this at any bank, at any time, but I'd prefer you do it within the next month." You can't take it with you. And it is such an obvious, simple truth. And yet, it is a truth we are constantly in need of being reminded of. I mean, Jesus says the same thing about the rich fool who, when he dies, has all this stuff in his barns, and to whom will they now be given? It's obvious, but it's not that simple. I mean, there's the here and now. And so we identify with that brother who interrupts Jesus' sermon, telling Jesus, "Bid my brother to share the inheritance with me." Now, we have to assume a couple of things, that he was the older brother who had control over the inheritance, and that the older brother was among the crowd, because Jesus is never making appointments when he's in the when we're told about him in the Gospels. And by and large, people, ministers, I myself, we've been critical of the man for interrupting Jesus, because if you look at the context, Jesus is talking about being concerned about those who can destroy the soul. He is challenging people to be true to their to confessing God before the world, and then this person, "Teacher, bid my brother divide the inheritance with me." It's a bit like the student who raises his hand, you know, at the time when you're talking about something that's really important to you, and he wants to know, "Is this going to be on the exam?" But in fact, the question is not quite as silly or irrelevant as you and I may think. It is, in fact, something which is significant. There's talk about it in Deuteronomy 21, Numbers 27, all about inheritance. And it was general enough that it left all kinds of questions. And so arguments oftentimes arose out of the fairness of the elder in the family with regards to the inheritance and the rest of the family. And so this man bids Jesus, tells Jesus to shape his brother up because he's ripping him off. Now, it's really not a request. He's really telling Jesus what Jesus needs to do. And then Jesus responds that he's not been called to be a divider, but instead a reconciler. And the way the man is making his demands, it's clear that he's not here to negotiate, to hear his brother's side of the story. He wants his way or the highway. And then Jesus refuses that approach and then turns to the man, the brother, and the whole audience. And then he says some really significant things. Jesus is the expert teacher who is able to take a bad interruption by a student, a bad question or a bad demand, and use it to bring out something wise and useful. And so Jesus does a couple of things. The first thing he does is he warns the brother, the brothers, and all of us. He warns us to be on guard against covetousness, to watch out for greed. And the word greed in the Greek is a word that really means be careful with this insatiable desire. This insatiable desire. In the scriptures, greed is seen as a very serious sin. I mean, Paul in Colossians 3, verse 5, says, put to death, therefore, the works of your human nature, that is, your nature that has lived outside of God. Put to death these things, evil desires, sexual immorality, and greed, which is like idolatry. Paul equates greed with idolatry. Insatiable desire. And you know, I remember reading, and I cannot remember where I read it, but it was a character in either a play or a book who kept saying, I want, I want, I want. And he'd never say what it was he wanted. He just would say, I want, I want. See, and there's something about us that's expressed in that wanting, namely that we have hungry hearts. We have hungry hearts. And when Jesus says, now be on guard, be watchful, he's saying, don't stuff those hungry hearts with whatever happens to be near at hand. And don't let this consumer, this pleasure-seeking, this fame-glorifying society tell you how to satisfy this hunger. Jesus says, life does not consist in the abundance of things. We could also say, to the more cultured among us, neither does life consist in the quality of things. Life does not consist in the quality or in the abundance of our possessions. I came across, as I reflected on this fact that our life does not consist in the abundance of possessions, I thought again, you know, that's again something that's really relatively obvious. We all know that we have to pare down, and after a while we are left with very little. And if our life really were to consist of these things, we would be undone. And maybe sometimes we do feel undone. But it's also true that possessions, and now let's just boil it down to money, has a huge role in our lives. I mean, there's a reason why worshiping God and worshiping mammon are tough contenders. Because money can do pretty much what God promises to do. Money can provide you with a lot of security, a sense of security. I mean, there are people who are so poor that if their battery goes dead or if their furnace goes out, it is a disaster. For most of us, it's a bump in the road. Money provides security. More than that, money provides a sense of self-esteem. People think well of people whose houses have curb appeal. Status. It provides status. You're poor, you just go down on the scale. And you know what else? Money provides an escape from boredom. It can provide pleasure. It can make your life exciting. You can plan trips. So when we say life does not consist in the abundance of things, we need to be honest. It's a temptation. But let me suggest some other things. Barbara Taylor Brown brought this to my attention. She mentioned a movie that I had not seen, I had heard of, but it was made back in 1998, Fight Club. Fight Club. Brad Pitt is one of the main characters. And it's a strange movie. Carol and I started to watch it, and then, anyway, Amazon broke down, and so we were in the midst of it, and there it stopped. But I got the line that I wanted to read to you. Because it's 1998, so this is before Donald Trump. There are a lot of angry young men. And they gather and they start these bare-knuckled fight clubs. And in one of them, the character who is Brad Pitt, they meet in some low-life basement, and Brad Pitt has a speech, and he says this, addressing them within one night, he says, "I have seen in Fight Club the smartest, strongest men who ever lived. I see all this potential, and I see it squandered. An entire generation pumping gas and waiting tables, slaves with white collars. Advertising has us chasing cars and clothes, working jobs we hate so we can buy crap we don't need. We're the middle children of history. Man," he says, "we have no purpose, no place. We have no great war. We have no great depression. Our great war is a spiritual war. Our great depression is our lives. We have been raised on television to believe that one day we will all be millionaires and movie gods and rock stars, but we won't. We're slowly learning that fact, and we're angry. We're very, very angry because society promises and we don't get it. Anger." And then they fight. And the fighting is to show them that they're tough. They can inflict pain, and they can receive pain, and rise up and leave a man. And the point, of course, is that if life does not consist of the abundance of things, neither does it consist of being tough, tough as nails. One more example. And I came across this, of all places, in the New York Review of Books. And it's a book, it's two books, American Girls, Social Media and the Secret Lives of Teenagers, and then Girls and Sex, navigating the complicated new landscape. I'm going to change some of the language, but here's how some of what it says. Sales, one of the authors, all of her interview subjects agree that on sites like Instagram and Facebook, female popularity, as qualified by the number of likes a girl's photo receives, depends on being hot. For a girl, you have to be that certain way to get the boy's attention. I guarantee you, says a 17-year-old from New Jersey, quote, every girl wishes she could get 300 likes on her pictures because that means you're the girl everybody wants to date and everybody wants to be the girl who is wanted for a date. Every girl who isn't that girl secretly hates herself. It's empowering. It's empowering to be hot. Being hot gets you everything. And then again I thought, Jesus says that life does not consist in the abundance of things, nor does it consist in being tough, nor does it consist in being hot, nor does it consist in being smart, nor does it consist in being the next Pele. It does not consist in these things, Jesus says. Now, what then does it consist in? Jesus tells a parable. We all know this parable, but it's worth just reading it again. The land of a rich man. So he's already rich, and it's the land that brings forth plentifully. And he thought to himself, what shall I do? I comes up, and it's a very great point. I have nowhere to store my crops. And he said, I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build larger ones. And there I will store all my grain, and I will say to myself, self, you have ample goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, drink, eat, drink, be merry. Now, as I said, this selfishness, this self-centeredness is quite obvious. One commentator who has the unfortunate name of Snotgrass, but he has a very good commentary, he thinks that this parable needs to have a voice at the table when you're thinking about retirement. Talk about relevance, right? The temptation is to build barns, to have a portfolio so that you can say, I can last the next 30 years. I was talking to somebody recently who was kind of ticked. He says, you know, there are some people who give their money to their kids, and then they live longer than they thought they would, and then they run out of money, and then the rest of the residents are asked to chip in so that they don't get kicked out. Well, I say, kick their asses out. That's what I think. How much do you think you need? I mean, you get all kinds of numbers. Well, it depends how much you want and what you think makes life worth living. I mean, people have these bucket lists. They have no money for anything else. Jesus says, you fool. And by fool here, you know in the scriptures, a fool is someone who does not consider God in all of his or her plans. That's a fool. They're just blind to reality. This night, your life is required of you, and the things you have prepared, whose will they be? So are those who lay up for themselves treasures and are not rich towards God. So here we come to what is obviously at the very heart of my whole ministry. How do we become a people who are rich towards God? I mean, I thought, what does it mean to be rich towards God? Do you know, what would you think it means to be rich towards God? Well, when I, you know, did my reading and the like and thinking, I mean, it means, surely it means in part to have a deep sense of the reality of God, God's presence in your life. Kenneth Bailey, who has a marvelous commentary on the parables, says to be rich towards God means serving God, service. I think to be rich in God or towards God is to have a life that has a kind of friendship with God. I was reading this book, Night Comes, and it's about death and what happens after we die and what the church has taught about heaven and hell and all of that. But in that book, he makes, the author, Allison, makes a comparison, and he doesn't use it the way I'm going to use it, but I think it's a really, really interesting comparison in helping you and me to think about what it means to be rich towards God, because that's what life is about. It's not about possessions. It's not about being hot. It's not about being smart. It's not about any of these things. It's about being rich towards God. So in this book, Allison makes a comparison between how we respond to money versus how we respond to a glorious sunset. Okay? And this is, again, simplistic, but usually if you fantasize a sudden, you know, the Powerball, whatever, that you get millions of dollars, you fantasize about all that money and what you can do with it, what you're going to do with it, what you're going to buy with it. Whereas he says, with the sunset, it's so much not something that you can possess that the only response it elicits is delight. You praise it, or the one who made it. And you may run into the house and get your family or friends, look at this. Right? And perhaps to have a rich life towards God is to have a life where everything, like the sunset, brings to you delight, makes you raise your hand in praise to Jesus for the goodness that he shows you, and makes you ask, how does God want me to use this, work with this, enjoy this? So you have this ongoing dialogue so that we are in constant conversation with God and in seeking to live a life that fits the life of the kingdom. We can't take it with us. We're only here for a little while. And while we are here, we're to assist one another in being rich towards God, in being friends of God, being servants of God, being lovers of God, being children of God. May it be so for us that this week we delight in God's presence and seek to serve God and give him thanks for all the goodness that surrounds us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen.